Before you dive in, let's talk about something crucial: taking care of the people who take care of us. Did you know 1 in 6 US healthcare workers is thinking about quitting this month? That's a crisis we can't ignore. Enter Evoke, a game-changing wellness app designed just for healthcare pros. With bite-sized interactive sessions on stress relief, conflict resolution, and self-care, Evoke makes it easy to recharge anytime, anywhere. Best part? It's just $9 per employee per year. No hidden fees. Visit evokeforwork.com. That's Evoke, the number 4, work.com, and start supporting your team today. Namaste and welcome back to another episode of The Sapient. Today, we have Dr. Sameer here. And throughout the episode, we'll, you know, sort of go through a lot of stages of health and everything. And Dr. Sameer, how are you doing? And can you introduce yourself?
Hey, thank you so much. I'm not yet a doctor. My PhD will be finished in a couple of months, God willing. So, but thank you so much for that. It's a pleasure. So my name is Sameer. I'm a health coach and a PhD in anthropology here in South Africa. And yeah, I really focus on getting people healthy and the sort of the root causes of chronic disease, especially.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And what was your, like, I would say initial interest, right? That piqued your interest and said, okay, this is what I want to do.
You know, I've been interested in health probably my whole life. From a very young age, 16, 17, 18 years old, I started noticing, I myself was overweight, and I started noticing that something just didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I started talking with doctors and nutritionists, and not really mainstream, it was alternative. And what was interesting to me, or what I thought was the right idea at that time, was this whole vegan and vegetarian thing and so on. Mm-hmm. So from about the age of 18, I became very strict vegan. Mm-hmm. And then later on, I was traveling all over the world. Even my wife is from India. And the idea at that time of not having, you know, milk in your tea was something that I couldn't explain to my in-laws.
Yeah, that's almost criminal, right?
Yeah. So I sort of changed. I was no longer a strict vegan. I became a sort of Indian vegetarian. And then for many years, it was like that. And then later on, my daughter was born in 2009. Mm-hmm. And her health, my daughter's health, and also my wife's health after that was not so good. Mm-hmm. And I got quite angry because I was like, why can't I figure this out? I know so much. I'm such a clever person. And I'm very humbly trying to say that. But that's mm-hmm. I know that I have these skills.
Yeah.
But I just had all the wrong information. So later on, 2016, I was getting laid off from my company. There were some job cuts and so on. And a friend of mine said, look, why don't you come and start a PhD with me? So I started the PhD. I took admission in the university, but I didn't go to the library I was meant to go to. I went to the medical library. Mm-hmm. And I started, you know, but I'm a researcher of anthropology and history and all these things. Yeah. So I didn't, you know, when I go to the medical library, I wasn't thinking, you know, what is the latest textbooks? You know, what is the medical curriculum I should be downloading? That's not how I thought. How I thought was, what is the history of all these things? Mm-hmm. So I looked at the oldest documents from the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, and then onwards. And I became very angry. Mm-hmm. I became very angry very quickly because I learned very quickly that everything I had been taught about food, about nutrition, not only was it wrong, it's one thing to be wrong, but it was demonstrably false. Mm-hmm. For example, we had known 100 years ago, 150 mm-hmm. years ago, that a diet of mostly meat can cure diabetes, for example, mm-hmm. right? So that knowledge was never passed on to me where I was, even though I was active in health spaces, I was going to the yoga classes, I was talking to all these so-called mm-hmm. nutritionists and so on. The very basics, which is that all of these chronic disease can be reversed, have been reversed by doing mm-hmm. the opposite of what these people are telling you. They're telling you to eat your fruits and vegetables. But they were being cured 150 years ago by doctors telling people to eat mostly meat. So mm-hmm. that was the beginning of my journey. And then since then, I got so angry. I said, okay, what can I do so that other people will also learn from me? Because when you look around in the society, mm-hmm. for us, you must know, Ganeshji, when you go around to see your uncles in the parties, everyone has a belly. Everyone is mm-hmm. not in good health. People, you ask people how they're doing. They're on this medication, that medication. Yeah. So I said, how can I do this? So I got my health and nutrition certification in 2021. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've been coaching people in many, many cases of diabetes reversal, heart disease improvement, and many other things, autoimmune reversal. So that's really my specialty.
Got it. Because if you look, you know, I'm not as knowledgeable as you, of course, in healthcare. But if you look at just diabetes as one thing, right? Or if you look at it as an industry, because that's what it is, you know, the standard of, you know, a non-diabetic and a diabetic has always been sliding, right? And it's like there is no clear explanation of why, you know, is that a thing?
Yeah.
And even in developed countries, the issue is this, right? Even in developed countries, you know, people don't have access to this. And it's almost seen something that's like taboo, right?
Yeah.
They're like, why would you, like, diabetes is not reversible. Like, that's the first point. Anytime I talk to a Western doctor, that's the first thing they say.
Yeah. I believe just in the last year or two, I think it's the American Diabetes Association that has for the first time written in its guidelines that diabetes can be reversed, type 2 diabetes can be reversed under certain circumstances. So that's a huge step forward. That's a huge change. But of course, these things are still changing slowly, more slowly than we would like to see. I think when they've seen so many hundreds of cases of it, because, you know, diabetes reversal is something I do every day. Like I see it literally, maybe not every day, but at least once a week, I see people coming off their meds.
Yeah.
So when you have so many cases, and there's many, many, many people like me who are helping people do the same. So when you have so many cases, then I think it's difficult for the institutions to continue saying what they've been saying, and they have to change their
and
stance.
And also it's like a lot of doctors push diabetes management, right? Rather than diabetes reversal. And I think that's the same
whole
with a lot
managed,
of chronic
the management
issues.
Is the whole, that's what's been sold, right? So I was talking with a patient yesterday, and she is rightfully confused because I'm telling her, you know, lower the carbs. And as a result of lowering the carbs, you'll have to lower the insulin. But she is very afraid because, you know, she's been taught all these years that when the blood sugar goes high, I need to inject more insulin, right?
Yeah.
So I explained it to her, like, I don't know if you guys play this game, this Vish Amrit. Yeah. This is like poison and elixir, right? Or poison and the cure. Yeah. Like it's a kid's game. So I said, look, carbohydrate is your poison, is your Vish. Mm-hmm. And when that Amrit is the insulin. Now, that's fine, but I don't want you taking the poison in the first place. If you don't take the poison, then you won't have to take the cure.
Exactly.
Make sense?
Yeah.
So, but it's very, very, very difficult for someone who's been injecting insulin for 20, 30 years to get their head around this.
Yeah. Also, it's like not only diabetes, but a lot of diseases that are reversible, right? Are not being worked on, right? It's like they would rather manage it. They would rather, you know, put you on a program than actually, you know, just get rid of it.
That's so. I think, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done around this history. I don't know how deep you want to go into the history in this conversation, but when you look at what happened, you know, so let's talk about, there's a great book out. I think it's called Rethinking Diabetes by Gary Taubes. It's out in the last year or so. Fantastic book. And what he's done, he's looked at, there was a certain strain of scholarship in Germany specifically, but actually it was all over the world. Mm-hmm. Prior to the invention of insulin, or not invention, but there was a process whereby insulin could be derived from animal blood, right? Mm-hmm. In the 1920s or 30s. And prior to that, the only way to treat diabetics, at that point it was mostly type 1 diabetics we're talking about, the only way to treat them was to reduce the carbohydrate load. And then you couldn't cure them, but you could give them a much healthier and a much longer life. Still, they would die in their 20s and 30s because they weren't producing any insulin at all. Okay. But if you didn't do the low carbohydrate diet, they would die, you know, in childhood, basically. Makes sense?
Of course.
So this was known and it was being used. But then once insulin was derived, people were like, well, eating just the animal diet is very difficult. So it's better just eat what you want. And that led to this whole idea of you cover the carbs. You take a scale, you weigh out how much rice you want, you weigh out how much roti, how much wheat you want. And then based on that, here's the conversion chart. If you have 100 grams of roti, you need 20 units of insulin, whatever it is for the individual. Make sense? So that led to this whole, what you're calling disease management. It's totally that paradigm. But we've known from the beginning that you can reduce the need for insulin substantially. And by the way, we know that the more insulin a patient injects, the worse they're going to be, the more likely they're going to have diabetic neuropathy, which is a terrible condition where you have pain in your fingers and legs, and eventually you have paralysis there, right? The more likely you are to have diabetic blindness, right? The more likely you are to have organ failure, right? So injecting insulin is not a good solution. We've known this all along. But so we've known that that's not a good solution, but that's still what the disease management wants you to do. They want you to inject that insulin.
And also it's like, I would say this type of message, right, what you just said, is, I would say, mechanically being suppressed, right? Because it's like, you know, it's the late stage of capitalism where you pay for everything, yet you own nothing. It's similar to that, right? Like, you pay for the maintenance and people are desperate, right? They would want reversals. They would want to get rid of these issues, which are also hereditary, right? It's not like, you know, it's like their bad lifestyle brought them to this.
I like that. That's a very good way of looking at it. I gave a talk yesterday on sort of capitalism and carbohydrate addiction. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. You're paying for a lot of things, but you're not really owning anything. And in fact, you're controlled. You're being sort of shoveled into this system, which is just extracting money for you, which you didn't need to give. Like, you know, from my way, people say that it's expensive to work with a health coach. Yeah, it may be expensive to work with me. Like, maybe I'm costing $1,000 for a few months or whatever my course cost is. Yeah. But if you compare that with injecting insulin for the rest of your life,
it's nothing.
I mean, I'm saving people lots and lots of money.
Yeah. And, you know, especially in Asian countries where, you know, people are very cost conscious. And I hate the term cost conscious because people talk about India as being one of the cost conscious market. It's not. Right. Like right now, there is a bed company selling a bed at like $1,200.
Yeah.
And if it was a cost conscious market, that would not work. And, you know, there are diabetes reversal programs which cost more than upwards of $5,000, which still, you know, people are buying it, right? So it, you know, that's a narrative that people are trying to push in terms of, even in US, they are like, you know, healthcare is so expensive. A particular, you know, path of, you know, medicine can be expensive. Not everything is expensive, right?
I mean, you got to be careful here, Ganesh, because there's lots of frauds and charlatans out there, right? And when we talk about the health, like this is going back to many centuries ago, if you're selling someone health, you know, if you're in bad health, you will pay almost anything for that, right? And there are many less than honest people who are taking advantage of that. So I think it's important to be conscious of that. But if we actually have a program, so I can guarantee you, well, I can't guarantee you, but I do offer a money back guarantee. That if you do what I say, if you do what I say and you do not substantially improve whatever your chronic illness is, I will give you your money back. No questions asked, right? But you have to come to the classes, you have to do the work, you have to make the changes to your diet, you have to make the changes to your diet, you have to do the exercise routine and so on. If you do all of those things and you don't see significant improvement, then I must have failed. My program must not work. But I've never seen it fail. I've never had to give that money back guarantee as yet. Right? Because the only time it fails, it does fail from time to time, but it fails when people cannot make the behavior change for whatever reason.
Yeah. And they get back to their old habits,
100%. Right? 100%. Yeah. 100%. And some people would rather just rather take the drugs. The drugs are also expensive. These days you have Ozempic and the GLP-1 agonists and so on. Mm-hmm. And those drugs are super expensive, but they're also sold out. They're super popular. So because people, again, would rather have the easy fix. And I think what your audience should also understand is all of those easy fixes are also coming with a cost. Maybe we don't even know the full cost right now. We don't know the long-term side effects completely, but there is a cost, I can promise you.
Yeah, because my mother is also diabetic. So, you know, she was on insulin, right? So currently she's going through, she has cancer, like she has breast cancer. So doctors are trying to manage her diabetes before operating. So I'm saying all the things that you're saying, right, where it's like, you know, they would rather give insulin and they would rather push more units of insulin than actually treat the issue, right? Yeah. And, you know, in this particular case, I think it's okay because it's like we are trying to prepare for this one surgery, right? But as a life, right, when there is no emergency, it doesn't make sense for people to keep taking drugs and not actually treat it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about that. One of the things to say, so I can't speak to your mother's case because I don't have her file in front of me. She's not in front of me. I can't talk specifically about that. But what I can tell you is that breast cancer is very related to diabetes and obesity in general. And if you are obese or if you have type 2 diabetes, your chances of developing any kind of cancer goes up, I think, something like tenfold. Okay. Mm-hmm. So those are both metabolic diseases. That's point one. So cancer and diabetes are related and blood sugar control and insulin, what's called insulin resistance. I prefer to call it hyperinsulinemia, high insulin levels. These things are all related. So when you're injecting that insulin into a type 2 diabetic who has cancer, you're actually exacerbating the problem. Because the problem, one of the problems is high insulin levels. You're making the insulin higher. Okay, that's the second thing to say about it. The third thing to say about it is we know from extensive research done out of, I believe it's MIT or Boston University in the US, by a doctor named Dr. Thomas Seyfried, who is a researcher. He's also a medical doctor, but I don't think he practices anymore, but he's a cancer researcher. And he has looked at all of the things that cancer cells can survive on. And his takeaway is that cancer cells, especially certain forms of cancer, breast cancer was in the list that I'm talking about, they can only survive on two forms of fuel. One of them is glucose. The other one is something called glutamine, an amino acid. Now, there are very cheap drugs. You can't go on a glutamine blocker forever. Because if you block glutamine forever, many, many cells in the body need glutamine. But you can do what's called a press pulse strategy. So you can go on the drug for a couple of weeks and then you can come off it. And that will suppress the cancer, sometimes with great effect. Sometimes you may need still need an operation. Again, I can't speak to an individual case. But the glucose piece of it is pretty easy because the success stories of people going on a ketogenic diet and reversing their breast cancer, or at least stopping the growth, which is the main concern, those stories are in the thousands by now, many, many, many stories. And we have, in fact, a randomized controlled trial done out of Simon Fraser University in Canada, which is showing that ketogenic diet plus standard of care. So we're not advising that people don't listen to their oncologist. We're not advising that people don't get the operation or that don't get radiology or don't do the chemotherapy. But if you're going to do those things and you go on a ketogenic diet, the outcomes were much, much, much better in this study. Make sense?
Yep, that makes sense.
So ketogenic diet means at least, of course, glucose is always going to be a low level of glucose in the blood, but cancers need a lot of glucose. They're glucose hungry. And in fact, every doctor knows this. Why does every doctor know this? Because there's something called a PET scan, P-E-T. What is a PET scan? You inject glucose, irradiated glucose, into the blood. And within a few minutes, that glucose gets taken up by the cancerous cells at a rate that is far greater than the rate that is taken up by normal cells. So you can take a picture and you can see exactly where the cancer is. Every doctor does this. Every doctor knows this. So, and because the need for glucose is so high, if we don't give them glucose, if we just keep the glucose in the diet very, very low by going on ketogenic macros or whatever it may be, which is a high fat, low carb diet, close to zero carb diet if possible, then we can actually at least stop the spread of cancer and in some cases even reverse it.
Yeah, but it's like a lot of this, a lot of these things are like not discussed, right, on a daily basis.
I don't know why oncologists don't discuss this. This has been known. Dr. Seyfried's work has been known for at least 10 or 20 years. Like it's not that revolutionary. And his work is based on the work of Otto Warburg, who created something called the Warburg effect. What I described with the cancer cells taking up the glucose, that was first discovered by Otto Warburg. Again, going back to the book I mentioned at the beginning, Gary Taubes' book, where Dr. Warburg is one of the key protagonists there. Where he discovered that, you know, there's this relationship between cancer and sugar, and cancer just loves the sugar. So if you take the sugar, I should just specify, means not just your processed sugar, all sugars, including banana, apple, fruits, sugar as well. If you take that out of the diet, the cancer, in some cases, it will die off completely. It depends how glucose sensitive it is. In some cases, you need that other medicine as well. And in some cases, you will need the standard of care. You will need the radiation. You will need all the other stuff too. So again, this isn't medical advice, but I would advise people like your mother to look into these options and to understand that a lot is known about the relationship between diet and cancer, and a lot can be done through diet and lifestyle.
Yeah, I guess what you're trying to say is, you know, just ask more questions, right, to your healthcare provider, and also be little bit more knowledgeable about the issues, right?
You're going to have to. So what happens, you know, why people like me get involved is, why do people come to me? They come to me because they've been to seven different doctors who told them seven different things. They've been yanked around the system. They've been given this drug, which had this side effect. They've been given that drug, which had the other side effect. So when that's all done, what I'm telling them is, look, there's no reason for you to get frustrated at your doctors. Why? Because you are the one who's in charge of your health. Now, I know you're not an expert, but there's no one else who has as much expertise in your own body than you. Make sense? So I can teach you how to understand, how to feel, how to sort of take away the static. You know, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of this background noise. I can teach you how to lower that background noise so you can actually be in touch with your own body and you can understand what's going on. And you can make the changes that will allow that to happen. And then you are in charge. You tell your doctor what you want. For example, my father has a very rare autoimmune disease. And he was doing all kinds of things. I had him put on a continuous glucose monitor, which is, so again, it's to do with blood sugar. The blood sugar spikes in autoimmune will just make it worse. It causes inflammation. It just makes everything worse, right? So that has helped. And now he also knows, we also measured his fasting insulin. His fasting insulin came low. So we're inquiring. And now I had to do this. I had to do this with my doc, with my dad, and say, look, the blood sugar is high. But you don't have type 2 diabetes, because type 2 diabetes, the insulin would be high, but your insulin is close to zero. So, and the autoimmune disease you have, it affects the pancreas, or it can. So are you moving towards type 1 diabetes? Can we get a C-peptide scan? Can we get tests? Now you have to get tested for type 1 diabetes, because it looks like you're headed in that direction. And if you're headed in that direction, then you do need to inject some insulin, for example, right? So he, now he's in charge. He's the one who's telling his doctors those things. They didn't know that. They weren't testing for that.
Yeah.
And because he's done that, he's, you know, he's on much better treatment programs than he was before. Before, he thought, oh, it's so complicated. This is a very rare autoimmune disease. It affects one in 100 million people or whatever it is. Therefore, no one knows. No one knows, but you know. It's your body. You know how you feel, right? So you should have the control over that.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, regarding the same thing, right? You had mentioned something about a low-fat guideline, right, from 1980s. So what's that? Like... We all know healthcare workers are heroes, but even heroes need support. And right now, they are struggling. One in 10 healthcare professionals is considering leaving the field this month alone. That's where Evoke comes in. Evoke is a powerful digital wellness solution built just for healthcare workers. In just minutes a day, it helps tackle burnout, stress, and secondary trauma through interactive game-like sessions. Think conflict resolution, self-compassion, and practical stress relief, built into bite-sized modules that fit even the busiest schedules. And here is the kicker. Unlimited access to Evoke just cost $9 per employee per year. No hidden fees, just real support for those who need it most. Ready to invest in your team's well-being? Learn more at evokeforwork.com. That's evoke, the number 4, work.com. Let's take care of those who take care of us. The link is in the description.
Where to begin the story? So there's a, you know, in Samir, a lot of...
I know a story is messed up with someone says, where to begin? Right.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, so I think the way to begin the story is that there were tribes going back to the 1950s and 60s. There were two tribes of people talking about these chronic diseases. One tribe was led by a man called Ansel Keys, who was not really a doctor. I mean, he was a fish scientist and an economist, but he was a towering personality and a very forceful personality. And he believed that it was the saturated fat and the cholesterol that was really the problem in the diet. And he not only believed that, he pushed it, and he selectively published data that basically proved that. He has something called the 7-country study. He actually collected data from 22 countries. And he said that in these countries, we see when people consume more fat, they have more heart disease. But he cherry picked. He only picked the 7 that actually most agreed with that hypothesis. If he picked all 22, it was still kind of in that direction, but certainly not so significant a correlation. And anyway, this is all correlation from correlation. We can't prove causation. There was another guy whose name I'm forgetting who said he was over in Britain. He said, no, it's the sugar. And it turned out that guy was right. That tribe was right. But that tribe lost. Okay. Now, that tribe was losing in the 1970s. Ansel Keys was still alive. He was still very active. And the 1970s is when the U.S. had various commissions because, it has to do with the fact that a president in the 1950s had a heart attack. No one stopped to ask that this president smokes 2 packets of cigarettes a day. 40 cigarettes a day he's smoking. It's not, and cigarettes do cause heart disease. Like, that is definitely known. But now it's, no one at the time said it's the cigarettes. They said, no, it must be the fact that he has eggs for breakfast. Come on, man. So that led to this whole anti-egg, anti-fat, anti-this campaign. And some people were saying, even in the 1978 commission where those guidelines were first proposed, some people were saying, look, we just don't have the data to propose these guidelines. Mm-hmm. It's not a good idea. But the government said, no, the US government said, no, we have to do something. So yeah. They did it. It came out in 1980, then again, 1985. Every guideline since that has basically been the same thing. Mm-hmm. The low-fat diet. And yeah. As soon as the low-fat diet gets done, I was living in the U.S. in those times. I was a very young, impressionable person. I'm born in 76. So in 1986, I'm 10 years old. And I'm being told, you know, we used to take skim milk. Instead, we used to put skim milk in our Honey Nut Cheerios and Golden Grahams and these super sugary cereals, not thinking that it's the sugar that's the problem. And now we've taken the fat out of our milk, so it tastes like you're putting bloody water on the milk. It tastes terrible. Water in the cereal. So we did all of that. We switched over from, you know, I'm coming from an Indian household. We were using ghee. And my grandmother used to have, you know, sort of non-veg fats. Mm-hmm. So like your mutton fat and all this stuff, she would keep it in a corner. Mm-hmm. That we got rid of. We told my grandma, no, you can't do that. We switched over to canola oil, which we now know was not a great idea. That was full of trans fats in those days. No one thinks trans fats are good, right?
Yeah.
So we did all these things that are actually making the diet much, much worse.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, many chronic disease rates started escalating. And when we look at, say, the accelerating rates of autoimmune, I had an autoimmune disease that started in about 1986, 1988, when I was 10 or 12 years old. But it was very unheard of. You know, the doctor, I remember when I got diagnosed, my doctor was grinning from ear to ear. Why was she so happy to see me? She had never seen a real life case of vitiligo. She was like, I've only seen this in textbooks. Let me take a picture. In those days, a picture meant getting out a camera from like an actual film roll. Yeah. So it was so exciting for her to see an actual autoimmune case because it was so rare. Now, you know, in my daughter's school, there's probably 10 cases of autoimmune just in her class of 100 people or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. So it's extremely common now. And it was extremely uncommon then. And one of the things that's happened, I mean, I think it correlates. Again, correlation is not causation. I can't prove this. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the low-fat guidelines come into place, then suddenly the disease rate starts skyrocketing. What's going on? Now, when you look a little bit deeper, you'll see that there's other things going on. So when we talk about heart disease in particular, the heart disease rates have dropped since then because smoking rates have dropped. And as I said, heart disease is very, very closely related with smoking. Mm-hmm. So because there are fewer smokers now, so heart disease rates have dropped, but many other kinds of diseases, including cancer, is on the rise.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I went to the local cancer research institution, and you know, even they were expanding their facilities. They are like, you know, the influx of, you know, people coming in, right, with diagnosed confirmed cancer issues is just like skyrocketed.
It's crazy. And of course, in India, we have other things too. We have so much pollution. We have, you know, chemicals, not so much regulation. So who knows what chemicals are in the water and so on. So in India, there are many, many factors, but the diet is probably still number one.
Yes.
Number one
and factor. Also, it's like getting out of, I would say, the Indian food regime and getting into the trends, right? Because right now, there are like a lot of American breakfasts and, you know, English breakfast spots in India. And it's like Americans themselves are quitting that, right? Like the super sugary stuff.
You mean pancakes and these kind of things, yeah?
Yeah, pancakes and, you know, Belgian waffles and everything. You know, like the originators of this food are trying to quit this.
That's a problem. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. So the problem we have in India is that we tend to see things in terms of veg, non-veg, which is a very, 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 very bad way to see things. Mm-hmm. So people think pancakes is healthy because it's veg. No, it's not. Yeah. It's not healthy, man. So I think once we know that, if you know that it's not healthy and you choose to eat it, that's your choice. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not taking away. I'm not against. If you want to drink your Coca-Cola, whatever, that's your choice. But you should know that when you're doing that, your chances of all these diseases goes way up. And some of the diseases, like you can say, okay, if I die of a heart attack in my 40s, young people think, yeah, it's okay, no big deal. Like that, you know, who cares? But there are other diseases that you probably care about, like erectile dysfunction.
Also, dying at 40 with modern medicine is a very bad thing.
It would be a bad thing, but we should remember that many heart attacks, you know, between the ages of like 45 and 55 is like peak heart attack age for men.
Season.
And many, many of those heart attacks, I think 40 or 50% are fatal.
Yeah.
The first heart attack is your last because you die, right? Mm.
Yeah.
And if you told that to me when I was 20 years old, I'd be like, yeah, okay, who cares?
Yeah, that's whatever, all right? I don't think I'll survive to that age.
Yeah, but if you told me that I would suffer from erectile dysfunction or that I'd suffer from Alzheimer's disease, then I might have a different, you know, thing, right? Because losing your mind and losing your ability to have sex, I mean, that's not fun, right? And that's not a good thing, right?
Yeah.
So there, I think people have to keep in mind that there's many things going on here. And, you know, you may die of a heart attack or you may lose your memory you know.
And I also read somewhere there was a doctor who was correlating the low-fat guidelines to Alzheimer's.
The 100%.
Increase in Alzheimer's,
right? No, 100%. So we've talked about cancer. We've talked about diabetes. Mm-hmm. The third thing that we should probably talk about is dementia/Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And you should know that in the literature, when we look through, mm-hmm. we do see that Alzheimer's and dementia in general is referred to often as type 3 diabetes. Okay. Mm-hmm. It is connected with what is often called insulin resistance of the brain. Again, I don't like that term. I prefer hyperinsulinemia of the brain, so high insulin levels. And it's just, this is all metabolism issues, right? The brain is a very energy hungry organ. The brain loves energy. Now, if you're giving it energy in the form of glucose, right, in the form of sugars, that comes with problems because sometimes there can be too much of that. And if there's too much of that, then the brain doesn't know what to do with it. The brain can't, there's no easy way for the brain to turn excess sugar into fat, which is what has to happen. So that has to happen at the liver. Anyway, it's a long process. But when you have chronically high sugar and chronically high insulin levels in the brain, it's a recipe for dementia, Alzheimer's, all the rest. It doesn't have to be that too. It can be other things too. Parkinson's disease, many other things can happen.
Yeah.
So what I advise people, remember that my PhD is in anthropology. So what I'm advising people to do is to look at history and say, look, what was the appropriate human diet, even 1,000 years ago, but especially 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at that, we see humans evolve. We know this from looking at our digestive tract. Now we can also do what's called a nitrogen analysis, what's it called? The radioactive isotope of nitrogen. We can look at that and we can see how much protein an animal was eating. And we see that that humans were eating more animal foods than, say, a big cat, say a mountain lion, 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So in that context, you were more of a carnivore than a mountain lion and you want to go pure veg now. You should expect some health repercussions for that. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this whole pure veg concept in India is a fairly new concept because prior to 1857, prior to the British taking control, all over in almost every temple all around India, you had non-veg being offered as prasad every Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And if you are a householder, if you're in the house, if you're brahmacharya or you're sannyas or whatever, so if you're in the beginning and end stages of life, there are different rules. But in the middle stage of life, the householder stage of life for a Hindu, you have to go to the temple on a Tuesday and you have to eat the prasad. And if the prasad is mutton, then you have to eat mutton, right? Mm-hmm. So this is all, it's only after the British come in and impose all kinds of taxes and regulations and forbid people to do hunting because they call it poaching, even though it was our forest, not their forest, right? So when they put in all these rules, then it becomes very expensive to offer meat as prasad. And if it's not offered as prasad, then people weren't going to eat it. So there's a great interview on my channel with Dr. Manushi Bhattacharya that goes into this in some detail, that all this pure veg concept that we have is a fairly new concept, at least for most people. There were ascetic traditions, Jain traditions, and so on that were vegetarian maybe a thousand years ago or more. But in terms of the big number of vegetarians we see post 1857 in India, that is a new phenomenon that never happened in Indian history.
So do you think in the modern times with availability of a lot of synthetic stuff too, right? Do you think it's like manageable with a veg, lifestyle?
It becomes very personalized. It becomes very personalized. And I just tell you what I see because I have lots of clients from India and it is very difficult to get people. So it's an unfortunate story and I won't tell you this person's name for the case of privacy, but she came to me, she was having all kinds of issues and yes, she was type 2 diabetic and I could tell that it was serious issues. She didn't really like paneer. You know, if you like paneer, that can be sort of an out because dairy fat, dairy fat is good and paneer has protein. She didn't like it. So she wasn't eating it much. And it was very, very difficult to get her to change her habits. So what happened was she had some kind of an incident. Now she needs a liver transplant. Now in this context, now because she's so sick, now her now she's doing what I told her to do, which is to eat, you know, 10 eggs a day, 12 eggs a day, or whatever it is. But that's basically, that's what's keeping her alive while she's waiting for this liver transplant, right? So and that's just one case. I see dozens of cases like this in India. So is it possible? I believe theoretically it's possible if you know what you're doing. And if you get enough animal protein in the form of paneer, I believe it could be possible. But it's not easy. And, you know, and also if you do things like fasting, I mean, that's something that Dr. Manashi brought up, that if you fast regularly and clean the system, you can, you can get rid of some of these vegetable toxins. See, vegetables are plants are contain what we call anti-nutrients, right? Everyone talks about plants have, you know, vitamins and so on. They do kind of, but those vitamins come with what's called anti-nutrients. And the anti-nutrients, these are lectins, these are phytates, these are other things that will bind to the nutrients in plants, meaning that you don't absorb them. So someone can present as obese. They can present as like, okay, this person, maybe they're overnourished. But in fact, you do all the tests and you find out that they have serious deficiencies. They may be deficient in, they're certainly deficient in iron. That's what I see with all the women who are vegetarian pretty much. They're probably deficient in B12. B12 is a very important nutrient for heart health in particular, but for all kinds of health, brain health as well. There,
It's also like, you know, we have to look at where our food standard is, right? Because I can tell you, because I am into foods, right? Like in 1957, when you compare 1957 to even 2011, right? The drop of iron in spinach is more than 98%. So it's like food doesn't have any more nutrition.
That's interesting. I would like to see that paper. The numbers that I have are not quite so stark. But spinach is a good example because spinach is a very, very high oxalate food, right? So when you're having spinach, if you a lot of people are blending up spinach and having it in a smoothie, not only does that oxalate bind to some of the minerals like iron, and so maybe it had iron at some point, but you're still not digesting it. It's not going into your system because it's being bound with the oxalates and going out. But the second thing is if those oxalates enter your system, then it has to leach calcium out of the bones. And it leaches calcium out of the bones. Then two things happen. One is you get osteoporosis. You get low calcium in the bones. The second is you get kidney stones, which we also see with lots of women who are eating lots of these oxalates and so on. Because most kidney stones are calcium oxalate stones, which are caused by eating excess oxalates.
Also, Samir, do you think like the whole, like the recent issue with almond milk, where it's like it absorbs calcium? Like, what do you think about that? Because, you know, if especially with veganism, right, the push of almond milk and anything other than dairy is very, you know, influential.
I mean, almond milk, again, it contains lectins. Now, if you process it a certain way and you pressure cook it and so on, you decrease the lectin thing. But almonds also contain things like cyanide, right? There's no real safe level of cyanide, right? So especially when you're talking about processing it, and especially people are using this because, of course, in their youth, they were having milk every day. All of us were given a glass of milk, glass of lassi, glass of chach. Like this was like, for me in North India especially, this was like, what we grew up. So people think they can replace that with the almond milk and so on. If you have that much almond, if you have almond milk once a week, it's probably one glass a week, probably no big deal. Your body can probably process it. But now you're having it every day. You're having it multiple glasses a day. How long before there's some kind of toxic effect? It's not going to be very long before before you start experiencing the toxic effects, right? So I'm not
also
saying
it's like there's also a whole industry behind it, right? Pushing 100%. Almond milk. Just like the, you know, people are trying to push whey protein,
100%.
You know, because essentially all of these are just excess of an industry, right? Like they were waste produced from an industry that people try to push to a certain, I don't know, profit motivated markets.
Yeah, I don't know about almonds. Certainly, the many things like that. Some of your seed oils definitely are that. You know, soybean oil and so on is basically
because. A YouTuber found an old manual for a machine where it said use canola oil for you know, machine maintenance.
Lubricant, yeah, of course.
Right? So it's like, also there is this whole industry, right, that is the whole marketing and changing the narrative of stuff. Because right now, if you look at US, you know, obesity is the biggest, like by far the biggest thing, right? Of course, which relates to what you help people with, which is heart conditions.
100%. Obesity is related to all of these things. So just to get back to something you just mentioned earlier, I think it's important to know the origins of some of the foods, right? So if we're talking about canola oil, for example, we can trace there's a process whereby canola oil is made, which involves detoxification, which involves, you have to take the smell out of it, et cetera, et cetera. It involves processing under high heat, which basically turns a significant proportion of it into trans fats, et cetera, et cetera. That process originated when? It originated at a time when the cotton, so in the US you had cotton was the crop.
Primary, yeah. Yeah,
now, when you plant cotton, these days you have genetically modified varieties that don't have so many seeds. But in the original days, the cotton was there, the big fluffy cotton thing. And also you had these little black seeds that had to be taken out, right? And if you're of a certain age, like I'm of a certain age, and you've ever seen cotton in the fields, as you drive around India, you'll remember that those seeds are very visible.
Seeds.
Yeah. So those cotton seeds used to be taken out and no one knew what to do with them as a big waste product. So someone figured out you can extract oil from it. Then what happened, at a certain point in the 18th century, they overhunted whales, right, in the US.
Yeah.
So they were no longer the whales that was used. Whales had many byproducts, but one byproduct was the oil from the whale that was used to light street lamps. Understand? Mm-hmm. So the whale oil was no longer available. Someone said, let's try and press this cotton and light the cottonseed oil, right? That was the street lamp. So for many years in the 19th century, that was the street lamp. Then towards the end of the 19th century, what happened? Someone invents electricity. Now again, we have all this cottonseed oil that's going to waste because you know, now the street lamps are powered by electricity. Someone said, well, sometimes the cottonseed oil, when it hardens, it looks a little bit like animal fat. It looks a little bit like lard, pig fat. So they said, why don't we just mix it in with some lard? Yeah. And at a certain point in time, it was forbidden to export lard from the US to Canada because all of the lard was tainted with this cottonseed oil and it tasted foul. It was not good. Mm-hmm. Then they came up with a company called, I think it was Crisco. Mm-hmm. They came up with a process whereby you could process this cottonseed oil into something that actually had no taste and it could be used as a substitute for lard. And they, even at that time in the 1920s, they were advertising that this is a healthier alternative to lard, even though there was no evidence for that, right?
Yeah.
So you can see the oil, and that same process is what is used today to make your canola oil and so on. So I think looking at the origins of these things is important and enlightening. And again, my advice is, if you're a human, maybe you should eat human food and not industrial waste products.
Maybe, right? Just maybe.
I mean, I people ask me for evidence of that. I don't have the evidence, but where was the evidence to introduce these things in the food supply in the first place? They didn't do any randomized controlled trials.
Mm-hmm. Also, most of these seed oils are relatively new.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All of them are new. I mean, canola oil, that's a very good example, because if you taste that, it's called a rapeseed. If you taste it, if you go out in the wild and you taste that stuff, I mean, it tastes absolutely foul. It's not good. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can
if you look at almond, if you look at almond, right, a lot of manufacturers, they're skimming oil. So they're extracting oil and then selling the dried out almond as fresh almond, right?
Yeah.
Like it contains nothing.
Yeah. Right. And almond oil is a luxury product, right? It has a certain, it's a high-end product. So they're producing it for that and they're selling the waste products.
Yeah, and they're selling the waste product as just regular almond.
Crazy.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, to kind of sum up our conversation, right? What do you think a common man or a woman, should follow in their life just to stay out of trouble?
Yeah, it really depends. So if we're talking about someone who's healthy, I would say there's, for me, there's two guidelines. So again, remember, I'm coming at this through the lens of an anthropologist. So what should a human eat? A human should eat the foods that humans evolved to eat. What are those? I would say 70% meat or other animal products, okay? Mm-hmm. Whole foods, animal products, 70% that. And the remaining 30%, if you are, let's quote unquote normal, if you're healthy, if you don't have any metabolic dysfunction, there's quite a bit of flexibility. Mm-hmm. But I would say stick to things that existed 100 years ago or 200 years ago. If you saw your grandmother or your great-grandmother cooking with those things, it's great. I would say go for that, right? So for most people, I'm including things like rice and wheat and so on. You can do that. Just be careful of things that didn't exist a couple hundred years ago. Now, if you have any kind of metabolic dysfunction, then I would say that the remaining 30% probably you should avoid the carbohydrates, because carbohydrate restriction seems to be extremely therapeutic for a number of things. Even something that's not related, like a wound healing. Like if you just have a cut or something and that wound is not healing, there are studies showing that if you go on a ketogenic diet, if you go on a very low carb diet, the wound healing improves, right? So I would say if you haven't tried a low carb approach or a ketogenic approach, low carb for me is, there's a group called D-Life India, which maybe some of your listeners may have heard of or maybe part of. Mm-hmm. By Anoop Singh is the founder. I was on their conference yesterday, in fact. You know, you can, if you're less than 100 grams carbohydrate restriction, you can do quite well. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go all the way to ketogenic, then I would say it has to be less than 50 grams of carbohydrate per day. But if you start at less than 100 grams of carbohydrate per day, and you'll find that, I think you'll find that many of your problems improve significantly.
Got it. So stick to your traditional food, right? Control your carbs.
Yeah, right. And non-veg based. I mean, I think that's the most important thing is you got to be, if you're a vegetarian and you can, mm-hmm. you can eat that much paneer, great. Otherwise, I think if you're a vegetarian and you're willing to introduce eggs, that's another option. But eggs, mm-hmm. most eggs I have to be careful of because most people just are not eating enough. Right?
Yeah.
Most people will say, I say, what do you have for breakfast? They say, I had eggs. I said, how many eggs do you have? They say, one egg. I said, that's not a dose of protein. One egg contains 6 grams of protein. If mm-hmm. you're a man, you probably need to be eating 30 grams of protein in a meal. That is 5 eggs. Mm-hmm. If you're a woman, you probably need to be eating 24, 25 grams of protein in a meal. That is 4 eggs. Mm-hmm. so, you know, until we get to 4 or 5 eggs, you're not really getting a proper protein dose.
Got it.
So keep that sort of thing in mind if you want to be vegetarian. If you're not vegetarian, then including more animal foods. Most people in India, even non-vegetarian people, simply not getting enough animal protein. So yeah. I think if you focus on that, a lot of things are going to improve.
Got it. So I hope that people follow this, right? People take this up seriously because it's their health, right? So this is not a financial advice or this is not a real estate advice that you can just be like, you know what, like, I might not practice it, right? This is something that is going to be beneficial for people, but also is going to improve their lifestyle, also life quality, right? So Samir, thank you so much for being here and, giving us this knowledge condensed advices, also, rooting out certain things that a lot of people don't want to speak about. So thank you so much for being here.
Cheers. Thank you, Ganesh. And if people want to check out my website, they're welcome to check out samirdosani.net, samirdosani.net.
So all of Samir's link, hopefully on social media, will be in the link description. So if you want to speak to Samir or if you want to consult him or take his services or anything, right, I would say just reach out to him and hopefully he can help you, bettering your life. And guys, this is the end of the episode. Thank you so much for being here. And until next episode, stay healthy and eat right things.